from the petitioners.
May it please the court, Mr. Kirk will present argument for the petitioners. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. The question in this case is whether to embrace the Court of Appeals announcement that a plaintiff, based simply on the fact that an accident or evidence of the fact that an accident occurred, can prove a manufacturing defect claim for a product that is more than 2.5 years old without
proof ever... is a little strong in a summary judgment case, isn't it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, the word proof?
You said can the mere fact of the accident prove it? You said in the procedural posture of this case that word's a little strong.
I recognize, Your Honor. That's a fair way to stand, Your Honor. But in this case, I think it's undisputed that the court acknowledges doesn't even have to allege a specific defect. Texas has always historically required a manufacturing defect claim for the product, for the plaintiff to show that the finished product deviated from its intended design in a way that left it unreasonably dangerous. In this case, without ever requiring the plaintiffs to allege or demonstrate how the product actually deviated from its intended design, the Court of Appeals held it sufficient to get to a jury simply for the plaintiff to provide testimony about how his vehicle caught on fire as he was driving it. And this is a vehicle that was purchased used 2.5 years after its original sale, had two prior owners and 54,000 miles of prior use on it, had aftermarket electrical equipment wired into the electrical system.
What if it was this old and it never had another owner? It never had any work done on it?
Your Honor, I think just the fact that it had that much use, and it's going to have, if it's had 54,000 miles, presumably intervening repairs made to it, even standard maintenance, it's going to raise inferences about what may have happened during those repairs or maintenance.
So you get a summary judgment if any adverse inferences can be raised?
No, Your Honor. We get a summary judgment because all of the inferences that could be raised from this evidence there's nothing that can be taken from these inferences other than a guess as to what caused the fire in this accident. Under the Lozano rule, what we have here is a guess, no matter who wants to posit it.
And in fairness, that's what the plaintiff's expert said. It's a guess.
Your Honor, he did say that he was just speculating it was an electrical malfunction. He didn't even, though, specify that it was an electrical malfunction caused by a manufacturing defect that existed at the time it left the manufacturer's hands. That's not provided even in the Greenwich affidavit. I think it really is beyond dispute in this case. There is no alleged defect, specific defect. It's just presumed. Now, using the concept of circumstantial evidence, the Court of Appeals reversed our summary judgment, saying that the story of how it caught fire was alone sufficient circumstantial evidence. And no one disagrees that circumstantial evidence can be used to prove a manufacturing defect. The question is how. And the use of circumstantial evidence shouldn't fundamentally alter the burdens of a party. A manufacturing defect, the plaintiff should have to prove through either direct or circumstantial evidence that the product deviated from its intended design in a way that left it unreasonably dangerous, and that deviation caused the injury or accident in question.
Exactly how do you think that works? If you're driving home a new car from the lot and it suddenly turns into a ball of flame, the plaintiff in that case doesn't have to do a lot of science to show what went wrong. You can just say, well, you're not supposed to drive home a new car and it turns into cinders. Is that the way it works? Or?
Your Honor, I'm glad you raised the hypothetical, because that's the concern that everyone might have, and that's the hypothetical I'm sure everyone, of course, thought of. Is what if this is a brand new product that fails, and we know that it's the exact same condition it was when it left the lot? Now, in that case, he may have a recovery, but that's not a manufacturing defect claim. This court, in preparing for argument, looking back over these cases and looking at Section 3 and what it was intended to do, I came across a series of cases from this court in its infancy in product liability, and it's the Coca-Cola exploding bottle cases. It's a series of three cases which ended in 1969 with this court's opinion of Pittsburgh Coca-Cola bottling. And I'd like to give this cite to the court because I think it's important for this case. It's 443 Southwest 2nd, 546. And what the court looked at there, we have apparently in the middle part of the last century, it was not uncommon for bottles to explode Coca-Cola for no unknown reason. And the court looked at can we allow recovery in those cases when there's not evidence of exactly why the bottle exploded, but we know it exploded as it was handed over from the manufacturer? And the court looked at res ipsa loquitur, and it took that doctrine. I think this is important because all of these tests, or at least Section 3 and some of the others, are trying to look at res ipsa loquitur and modify it in some way, and that's what the court did in the Coca-Cola bottling cases. It took res ipsa loquitur and said, can we modify it in a way that would allow recovery that would be fair? And in the Coca-Cola bottling cases, I think this court did as good as any court has ever done. And what it said was it required the first prong of res ipsa loquitur, which is, of course, that the injury would not have occurred in the absence of negligence. And it said, we'll modify the second prong of the control test, which is, and I want to quote the language of the court because I think it's really helpful, which is, if the plaintiff could prove that, quote, the bottle, one, was in no way accessible to extraneous harmful forces, and two, was carefully handled by the plaintiff or any third person who may have moved or touched it. Now, as I said, this Coca-Cola bottle case was a series of three cases. The first two really only spoke about negligence. The third spoke about negligence and strict liability. And in doing so, we see how the court developed this theory. In the first case, the bottle was handed over from the manufacturer, and it was 5 to 10 minutes from the time it was handed over until it exploded. And the court looked at that and said, well, we'll modify the control requirement. We understand it's no longer strictly in the control of the defendant, but 5 to 10 minutes, we're going to allow you recovery under res ipsa loquitur. Now, the second case, the bottle was delivered and sat on the shelf for 24 hours at store. That case came along. The court looked at it and said, it was on the store shelf for 24 hours. It was open and accessible to anyone who may or may not have come in. That's just too much to allow us.
So if the car was parked in the driveway overnight under Justice Heck's example, then that wouldn't be enough to establish liability.
Your Honor, it's not clear, and I'm sure from product to product it may vary, but under the third prong, and what the court said in the series of Coca-Cola bottling cases, well, there's two factors you look at. One is the time out of the defendant's hands, and the other is the amount of people who may have had access to it.
But we're talking about just one. I mean, just to get to that point, so if it's parked on the street overnight, what happens there under Coca-Cola bottling case?
Your Honor, obviously Coca-Cola bottling didn't deal with a product as complicated. I think it's something that would have to be meted out by the court if it's going to apply that rule on. I think that the only case that even begins to adopt a test sort of like Section 3 in Texas is the Barnett case, which is out of Waco, and it was 7 days and 500 miles, and it still allowed an inference there after 7 days and 500 miles. But I think that's actually one of the concerns that this court has to have. Is once you take the step, and this is the reason why we argue that you should have to show a specific defect. Once you take the step to allow recovery under fairness or any other guidelines, you're going to have those issues. You're going to have those concerns. We believe the best rule is to require to show a specific defect, and that way you get the best policy objectives of strict liability, which is you require them to show it, you know it's a defect, that way you spread the cost in known cases, not when there is no knowledge of it, and the manufacturer then has notice to go back and try to correct whatever problem may have occurred. Now, in the third case, which is the Pittsburgh case I cited, in that case, the bottle was delivered to the store, but was kept in a locked storeroom for 4 days and exploded when it was taken out. And the court said 4 days was longer than 24 hours, but since it was in a locked storeroom, we're going to allow recovery. And I think, Justice Jefferson, to answer your question, that's the court balancing these two factors of time and control and who had access to it to try to work out an equitable solution. And that's the approach that I think this court should take if it decides to abandon the requirement that you have to show a specific defect. But what we have to recognize is that Section 3 and this attempt to allow for an equitable recovery is not a manufacturing defect claim. It's something else. Section 3 is it's an inartful attempt to try to codify what courts have done to address this situation where we know the product is probably in the condition it was when it left the manufacturer's hands, and we want for equitable reasons to allow for recovery. When it does that, it raises these issues and concerns. We think the Coca-Cola bottling cases, if this court chooses to continue that ruling, which seems to have been lost in the last 30 years of products liability jurisprudence, but if it tends to do it, we think that's a much better test than the restatement. And as the amicus, which I'm not sure the court had a chance to read, I actually just received it yesterday afternoon, points out, Section 3 isn't really a strict test. It's more of an analytical framework, which leaves for the courts the ability to fill in specific procedures. But the problems with Section 3 and its language is, and there's two main problems. The first of which, it's loosely worded, and its amorphous language allows the person using it to interpret it to mean anything that they want. If you look at the two commentaries, the Owen and the Hoffman piece, there's a third I'd like to cite to the court. It's 68 Tennessee Law Review, 647. If you look at those three commentaries together, they can't agree on the basis of the test. They can't agree on its application. They can't agree on its limits. They can't agree on its purpose. It becomes obviously clear that Section 3, the way it's worded, and given that it was meant only to be a guidepost or analytical framework, but as it's actually worded, can be taken to mean anything. And it's an amorphous test which would greatly increase the kind of concerns and questions that the court has raised with this timeliness. Beyond that, Section 3, when it was first drafted, its original draft only applied to manufacturing defect claims. Now, by its own terms, it also applies to design claims. Now, you can ask, how does that even make sense if we don't know what the defect is? But by its own terms, it does. And it's indisputed that Section 3, and all the commentaries agree on this, is a consumer expectation test. Well, this court has adopted a risk utility test, and by statute, Texas requires a reasonable alternative design. Section 3 allows a plaintiff a way to end around that. It also has a lot of difficult...
What sense does the reasonable alternative design make if you're not complaining about the design, you're just complaining that the product was not built to the design?
It doesn't, Your Honor, if it was simply a manufacturing claim. But as I said, Section 3 in its language actually says this section also applies to design claims, which, granted, doesn't seem to make a lot of sense if you don't know what the actual defect was.
But you agree in a manufacturing defect case that you shouldn't have to prove safer design.
That's right, Your Honor. That's right. But the problem with Section 3 is it says this also includes a design case, and we know that you don't have to prove a reasonable alternative design under Section 3, so it would allow a plaintiff to do an end-around of the statutory requirements and also the risk utility test.
That was an issue in the Court of Appeals, but it's not an issue here.
That's right, Your Honor. They didn't appeal the determination from the Court of Appeals about the negligence finding. I'm sorry. Oh, okay.
Could you win this case on a straight summary judgment for, you know, negating all plaintiff's claims, or do you win it only if we treat it as 66A claim?
I think we win under either, Your Honor. I don't think the court ever needs to look past the no evidence summary judgment, because I think all the inferences this court needs are contained in the information that was filed in response to the motion attached to their response. But I think we went under either standard. All the inferences are present. They just get flushed out a little bit more if you look at the proof that was contained in Ford's motion. And Ford's motion was clearly filed with both a no evidence and a traditional motion. Now, basically what the plaintiffs are trying to do here is not prove what was wrong with the product, but allow for a manufacturing defect claim to go forward. It doesn't make sense. This court's jurisprudence, and Texas has probably the most developed liability or products liability jurisprudence in the nation, makes clear that we have different types of strict liability claims. And a manufacturing claim, the entire basis of a manufacturing claim is that the plaintiff proved the product deviated from its intended design. What the Court of Appeals has allowed to happen here is for us to abandon the one requirement of a manufacturing defect claim. Granted, it still has to be unreasonably dangerous, but that to show the product actually deviated from its intended design. That's not done here, and that's improper, and the court should require it.
Well, sounds like we're talking about two different things. Let's say it was a new car, and this happened. There was a hot spot in the engine compartment, and an expert concludes that it's most likely the result of an electrical system malfunction because there was no fuel smell, no circumstantial proof that it had anything to do with the fuel system. So, let's say this all happened in a brand new car. seems like you're still making, I thought you said at first that you could make a claim if it was a new car, but it sounds like what you're saying now, unless they can pinpoint the specific defect, you couldn't have a claim.
Right, Your Honor. We believe that Texas law requires a manufacturing claim to prove a specific defect. If the court wants to allow for an equitable exception for situations where we know the product is in the condition it was when it left the manufacturer's hands, there is case law in this court under the Coca-Cola bottle cases, under the lower courts under seal test, which could be used to answer that situation. That's not this case, but if this court mets out a rule, it should do that, which sets out straight and strict guidelines. And I only talk about that because Section 3 has been offered up here as an alternative. And
so you're saying you wouldn't have to necessarily allege a specific defect if you can show that the car was in the condition it was in when it left the manufacturer?
Your Honor, under the Coca-Cola bottle cases, the under seal test, arguably, under some sort of, you know, warranty theory, you could do that. And that's the problem. What you're really doing here is beginning to blend different forms of liability and bringing in from other jurisdictions different theories about, like, the malfunction theory, which we've never accepted for a strict liability claim. And all I'm saying is that we recognize in the brand-new product question that this court has recognized before an equitable exception under really a modified res ipsa loquitur.
And the reason for that is, I believe you're saying under the analogous exploding Coke bottle cases, because there's an inference that it's still in the same condition.
That's right, Your Honor.
And at some point of attenuation, that inference doesn't apply.
That's absolutely correct.
So it doesn't have anything to do with whether you allege a specific defect as much as the attenuation piece.
That's absolutely right, Your Honor. It's some form of equitable test the court has created simply to address situations where it would be impossible to prove a defect, but we all agree that the product was in the exact condition it was when it left the manufacturer.
So if they could connect the dots that it is in the exact condition it left, then really attenuation wouldn't matter, but that'd be a pretty heavy burden.
That would be an extremely difficult thing to do, Your Honor, and I don't think it could be done under any of the scenarios that we're given here, except for maybe the car that drives off the lot brand new and blows up on the way home.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court is ready to hear argument.
May it please the court, Mr. Rob Hughes will present argument for the response.
May it please the court. In this appeal, I think Ford has tried to twist the arguments around and twist the arguments of the plaintiffs around, or my clients, Mr. and Ms. Jack Ridgway. They have continuously brought up the res ipsa loquitur issue, and we have never argued res ipsa in this case. We have continually relied on third restatement of torts, Section 3, dealing with products liability. Also, another thing I think that they have kind of twisted around is what burden was on us at the summary judgment hearing. They keep talking about that we can't prove beyond a preponderance of the evidence. Well, my argument is all we had to do at this hearing was produce more than a scintilla of evidence.
And counsel, let's talk about that. It's your contention that the circumstantial evidence here raises a fact question that precludes summary judgment, right?
Yes.
The two pieces of circumstantial evidence are the eyewitness testimony of your client who was in the truck when the fire started and was injured.
Yes.
Right? And then you have an expert, Mr. Greenless. His testimony and his affidavit is his opinion. A malfunction of the electrical system in the engine compartment is suspected of having caused this incident. Webster's defines suspected as imagine something to be true or likely. Is Mr. Greenless's opinion any evidence?
Your Honor, I would argue that it is, because he also states in there that the vehicle was damaged severely. And he's telling you what he thinks he sees, or what he would see. And he also relies on what my client said. And I think what my client said is enough evidence. There are the Miles case, the Gonzalez case, and the Sipes versus General Motors case. They all say that witness testimony is enough evidence.
And I've looked at a couple of those cases. And I'll ask you about that in just a minute. Mr. Greenless also says that a hot spot, there's a hot spot in the engine compartment, and he opines that the fire started in the engine compartment, but can't identify or pinpoint the specific defect that caused the fire, correct?
Yes.
Should we allow cases to go forward if there's no identification of a defect that caused the injury, if there's just a suspicion that there was a defect, but that defect cannot be identified?
Mr. Coons mentioned the amicus brief that was filed yesterday. In that brief, the Products Liability Advisory Committee, they state that the purpose of the Restatement Third of Torts, Section 3, is an indeterminate defect inference comes into play when product is so damaged plaintiff is provided no fair opportunity to inspect and identify a specific defect. That's this case, Your Honor.
The briefing does say that neither party had access to the vehicle, and that's the reason, because it was...
There is access to the vehicle, but it is so severely damaged that where the fire started, you can't tell what is what.
Well, even in Gonzales, this is the last one I want to ask, Chief. Even in Gonzales, the expert testimony was sufficient to identify the defect. In Gonzales, there was an eyewitness that said, I saw the tire wobble and lean, and the evidence that it was sliding sideways rather than rolling. So there was eyewitness testimony, but the eyewitness testimony went to the source of the alleged defect to help identify it. In this case, even your client says that he originally saw the fire in the rearview mirror behind him. Your expert opines that the fire started in the engine compartment in front of him. Is that inconsistent?
No, Your Honor, it's not. Because of the flame patterns on the vehicle, it clearly shows that the fire came underneath the vehicle and then curled back up behind my client, behind the driver's compartment.
So the fire started in the engine compartment, and went under the vehicle, came up
behind, and as he was driving,
the passenger compartment?
Well, in the bed of the truck.
Behind the passenger compartment?
Yes, sir.
Why would the fire not come up around the engine compartment?
My client was driving, I think, about 35 or 40 miles an hour, so the wind and the aerodynamics of the vehicle caused it to do that.
You're not making any claim that your expert didn't get an adequate opportunity to examine this vehicle all he wanted, are you?
I am, and I'm not. I'm not saying that he didn't have the opportunity to go out there and inspect it. He had that opportunity.
He could do any further destructive tests or anything else he wanted to do on the car.
Well, I don't think he could have because of the damage.
How did he determine there was a hot spot in the engine compartment?
The entire driver's side part of the engine compartment is basically gone.
Expert Arlay has to raise a reasonable inference that whatever this defect was, it existed at the time the product left the manufacturer's control. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
And your expert never used a term stronger than suspected. Is that right? And he also said it might be the fuel line, which had been through a lot of other control.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that correct?
He did say that.
Well, let's set aside the reciprocity. You say you haven't argued in Section 2, but on this expert witness's affidavit, what cases do you have that would make the word suspected with an alternative explanation, which would clearly not allow recovery, that would make that strong enough to survive summary judgment? Is there a case you can turn to or a doctrine?
Your Honor, I cannot think of any specific case that deals with the word suspected. But there are, it's well established that in a no evidence summary judgment situation, you take any adverse inferences and ignore them. And you take all evidence that the plaintiff produces or the non-movement produces in the best light for them.
Okay, we'll ignore the fuel line then. And we just take suspected engine block. And an engine block that hasn't been opened, I suppose, is some evidence of what the manufacturer did. But let's get this word suspected. Is that enough to get to a jury?
I think in a no-evidence summary judgment situation, it is, Your Honor. If this was a traditional summary judgment, which I don't think Ford produced any summary judgment evidence in this, and that's why I'm saying it is a no-evidence summary judgment. But in this no-evidence summary judgment situation, I think that's enough because you have to take that, anything he says, in the best light and take it everything he says to be true.
Let me ask you, I don't have his affidavit in front of me, but I believe he said that he looked at the NHTSA reports. Is that right? The National?
Yes, National Highway Traffic Safety.
Right. What was in that report? Were there instances of similar occurrences in there?
Your Honor, I don't think
he... him to surmise that it was the engine?
I do not believe he found any recalls. I think that's what his search was for.
So he looked through NHTSA but saw no recalls on the engine compartment for a similar defect?
Correct.
It's kind of paradoxical because the more similar problems you find, the weaker your manufacturing defect case gets, I guess, and it grows over time.
Correct, and then you have to go to the design defect.
Without the expert's affidavit, can you get to the jury just on Section 3 or any other doctrine?
I do believe we can get there on Section 3 because we do have...
Setting aside the expert's affidavit, just on your eyewitness.
Yes, Your Honor, on my eyewitness and the other witness testimony. We do have access to the previous owners who testified that, you know, I think they stated in their affidavit they didn't misuse, didn't abuse. I think based on those facts, we can show that this vehicle was in the condition it was in when put into the stream of commerce. There's no evidence that this vehicle was ever misused or abused. It had 54,000 miles. And I think counsel's argument that once a vehicle's been used, you know, within reason was 500 or 600 miles.
Well, there was a spotlight on the driver's side front door that was installed, and that would have involved some work on the electrical system.
Yes, Your Honor, it would have, but at very minimal. Going back to what opposing counsel said about the Coca-Cola bottling cases, I think that we can't limit it to something that is brand new. In fact, I mean, Ford warranties these vehicles for 36,000.
It doesn't seem like you limit it at all.
Your Honor,
what is the limit?
There has to be some limit.
What is it? You just say, if a fella says, yes, I was standing there and it malfunctioned, that's enough to get to the jury.
In certain situations, it may be, Your Honor.
Well, which ones would it not be?
Let's say in a case of a vehicle case. You could even have situations where a vehicle only has 20,000 miles, 15,000 miles on it, but, you know, the guy's, you know, some shade tree mechanic is doing all the work, or, you know, somebody's doing the work for themselves. You know, they go in there and they do a tune-up.
If you had an affidavit that he'd seen a video on a tune-up and he did it fine? Yeah. And what you're saying here is affidavits from all the owners that they didn't trash the car and that they took it to reputable mechanics gets it to the jury.
Well, they say they took it to reputable dealers. Well, I think in that situation, Your Honor, you know, if somebody, you know, an uncertified mechanic, you're not taking it to a dealer, somebody who's authorized by the manufacturer to work on the vehicle, I think then that would cause serious problems for the plaintiff's case. But in this situation, where it was always taken to an authorized
So that's your answer to Justice Hatton.
I mean, that's one situation.
Proof from the prior owners, proper service and no mistreatment and no missing link in that chain get you to the jury under Section 3.
And in a situation like this where a vehicle is being driven on a paved county road and it ignites in the flames, I think so.
What if it had 100,000 miles? I mean, does the age or mileage have, is there some cutoff point?
Well, I think at 100,000 miles, you're starting to push it because...
Why?
Well, vehicle manufacturers pretty much will tell you that they manufacture their vehicles to last three times the amount of the warranty. So if they give you a 36,000-mile warranty, they're pretty much designing it to go about 115,000 miles. So when you get to 100,000, you're starting to push the envelope on what it was designed to do. And but at 50,000, it's well within that design ramifications.
And that's given us a case from Maryland Court of Special Appeals, and its reply brief that's pretty much on all fours with this one. The Harrison case, do you think that's just wrong, or did you find a distinction? If it doesn't come to mind, don't waste time now. Just drop us a letter.
Your Honor, to be honest, I do not recall the case. But another issue that the opposing counsel brought up was the under seal test. And basically, under seal test means the thing can't be touched. Once somebody opens up that hood and touches anything in there, that vehicle is no longer under seal. So again, we go back to the warranty situation. They've got to get in there. If somebody has any problems with the vehicle, and they take it into an authorized dealer to have repairs done, once they get in there and do some work, then it's no longer under seal. And Ford's argument would be that you can't have a case against it. Then you would have to prove a specific defect or a design defect to recover. And I just don't think that would be very equitable to do that to consumers when they go out and purchase a product that has a warranty, and they're told it'll be good for the duration the vehicle, or the product will be good for the duration of that warranty. I just do not think that would be fair. Ford also argues that we have to prove that the product deviated from its intended design. Motor vehicles are designed to be driven on public streets, private streets, and that's what Mr. Ridgway was doing in this situation. He was driving on the paved county road, obeying the speed limit when the vehicle caught on fire. I think we have proven that the vehicle deviated from its intended design. We can't prove a specific defect. We can't tell you what part specifically malfunctioned. But as I've explained, I mean, there are situations where the product is so damaged, or there are even cases where products have been lost and the plaintiffs have been allowed to go on based on eyewitness testimony alone. And I think that's what we're arguing. In this situation, in a no-evidence summary judgment, we should be allowed. We have produced more than a scintilla of evidence. We have met our burden in this situation.
McCombs Ford apparently worked on the fuel system of this truck a couple of times. They were non-suited from this case. Does Ford's argument that intervening repair work, the fact that could have caused the problem, does that preclude you're being successful in this case? Or put it another way, does that mean that Ford's motion should be successful?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't. One thing, I don't think any work was ever done on the fuel system. It was taken in and complaints were made about the fuel system. And I think some tests were done, but I don't think any repairs were actually performed on the fuel system. Further,
didn't you allege that one?
In our original petition, Your Honor, we abandoned that claim.
But at one point you alleged that there were three repairs in the fuel system.
Yeah, we alleged there were repairs, but I don't think, according to Red McCombs, they never repaired it. They never performed any repairs. The vehicle was taken in for that. But beside the point, I think even if the repairs were done, I mean, this is an authorized Ford dealer, and when you take a Ford vehicle to an authorized Ford dealer, they are Ford's agent.
Do you have any cases on that?
Not with me, Your Honor, but if I could submit
a
brief, I can. I mean, there are cases that say when you take it in for repair.
Short letter.
Sir?
Just any kind of notation.
Okay.
So the Harrison case, what you think of the Harrison case and Ford being responsible for dealer repairs in manufacturing defect setting.
You want just on manufacturing defect or, you know,
I don't think
breach
design would be very helpful. So.
Excuse me, Your Honor.
Design defect wouldn't be relevant. No. If there's something beyond manufacturing defect that's relevant, that's fine.
Okay. Going back to what I think is the crux of the argument here is that we are relying on the third restatement of torts, and we're asking the court to adopt that theory. Further, this is a no evidence summary judgment case. All we have to do is produce a scintilla, more than a scintilla of evidence. In this situation, I think we have. We don't need to prove beyond a preponderance of the evidence. It is just more than a scintilla. And that is not very much. In this case, I think we did produce that. And I think this case should be allowed to go to a jury.
Let me make sure I'm clear. Are you saying that you think a no evidence summary judgment standard is different from a no evidence standard after a jury trial? What if, let's say that we had the same evidence presented to a jury, and all you had was your expert saying, I suspect, and your other affidavits in testimony, and the jury finds in your favor, would that evidence be enough to support the jury's verdict, the suspected?
On a no evidence situation after it's submitted to a jury? Your Honor, I think that's basically, I think it would be. I mean, you would have to rely on the jury's judgment of what the testimony is.
Because I thought you said earlier that if this were a motion, if Ford had come forward with its own evidence saying affirmatively there's no defect, that your affidavit would not raise a fact issue. I wasn't clear about that.
Well, if they had risen some other defense with an affidavit or said, no, this is what caused it, then we would have to, if they brought forth an expert and said, no, the fire started here and this is what caused it, if they had done that, then we would have to bring forward someone to directly contradict what they're saying, or we would lose, because we would have to contradict what their evidence was. But they brought forth no evidence in this case.
Thank you, counsel.
I think this court's questioning clearly demonstrates the danger of adopting this special exception or equitable exception to requiring them to prove a specific defect. Every case, you're going to have to sit around and ask the questions that this court was asking. Well, what if it was 100,000 miles? Well, what if it had been repaired? And what if those repairs were one thing or the other? This court, over the last 35 years, has developed specific requirements for different types of claims. And for a manufacturing claim, they're supposed to prove, allege and prove, that the product deviated from its intended design. Now, he's admitted up here that they can't do that, and they don't intend to do that, and that should be it. And this court shouldn't allow some exception which will swallow the rule. Secondly, as to the standard, we've never said they have to prove by preponderance of the evidence. What we've said is that this evidence, and this is the close of discovery has been long ago. They had this car for a long time, and this is as good as it gets. There is no more evidence. And what we've said is, if you take this evidence to a jury, there's no way that they can come to any conclusion beyond a guess. And that's the standard for a directed verdict and a no evidence motion for summary judgment, and we should get that judgment here. And we did get the judgment, and the Court of Appeals reversed it. As to what his expert said, and this goes to Justice Wainwright's questions earlier, they did have possession of this vehicle. They did have a chance to inspect it. They have never alleged that they could not determine what a defect was. What they said was they haven't. In fact, in the expert affidavit, it tends to indicate they're going to keep trying, or they may keep trying. What we have here is a case, and this is what the amicus that was filed yesterday sort of goes to: what is Section 3, what was it meant to do, and how is it supposed to be applied under the framework of Texas. And what it says is, it's supposed to be limited to brand new products or relatively new products. It's supposed to be limited where you know it's in the condition it was when it left. It's supposed to be when the product was destroyed and it couldn't be proven. And it may have a few other requirements. None of those are met here. This isn't really a proper case to try to even argue for Section 3. And what the expert does, Section 3, the first requirement, the kind that ordinarily occurs as a result of a product defect, there's no evidence in this case. the expert or no one else ever says that a vehicle fire ordinarily occurs only because of a product defect. There's no evidence that it even meets the first requirement. The second requirement is that you disprove other possible causes, and this is just in the loose language used in the restatement. He doesn't even attempt to do that. And in fact, at the hearing, which was cited in the brief, what he seems to suggest is it's Ford's duty to somehow disprove any other possible causes. That's clearly not what Section 3 was intended in its analytical framework to suggest. If this court adopts some sort of exception modeled after Section 3 by bringing back its Coca-Cola bottle cases, we may have to met out all those issues. But it shouldn't do that because it's going to bring all these concerns and discrepancies and confusion into the law. Even under Section 3, there's no way to make a claim based on the evidence.
You're saying you win if we adopt Section 3, but we shouldn't adopt Section 3.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. What I'm saying is we win no matter what test this court adopts, unless the court decides to make manufacturers insurers of their products, period. Other than that, we have to win because there's no way, based on the evidence presented in this case, that any jury could conclude that there was a manufacturing defect by the time this product left the manufacturer's hands. It would merely be guess. It would merely be surmise. I'm willing to give them to be a guess or surmise that anything else caused it. In the briefing, we named 5 or 6 or 7 different possibilities that popped right to mind. But the court can envision the jury discussion if this case goes to the jury. Sit around saying, well, do you think it was caused by a manufacturing defect? I don't know. Do you think it was at the time it left? Well, you know, I've had a car before that had problems when it left the manufacturer. Well, I've had repairs that were done by my local shop, and they didn't fix it right, so maybe it was caused by that. That's what's going to happen in this case. It's improper. The court's jurisprudence requires them to prove a specific defect. That's what it should stick with.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument that the subject raised. I'll take another brief recess.
All rise.